Hi, everybody. Welcome to Past Lives. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks so much for joining me today for our first main feed interview. One of the great joys of doing history for a living is that you have friends who can tell you everything you want to know about times and places where you've never spent much time. Colonial America is one of those places for me. Like most of you, I got the potted version of early American history, a straight line from intrepid colonists and their unshakably already American principles to a nation destined to rule a continent, with a few minor genocidal oopsies sprinkled in. But just how diverse and idiosyncratic the colonies were and how varied the lives lived in them were was never clear to me. But they were extraordinarily diverse and fascinating places. And many of the people who lived there lived lives that were indelibly shaped by slavery. Today, we'll meet one of those people and try to understand what we can of his life. Our guest today was tied for the title of returning champion on Tides of History, and this marks what I'm sure will be only the first of many appearances on Past Lives. Dr. Keith Plimers is associate professor of history at Illinois State University, the author of numerous journal articles and book chapters, and a lovely book entitled No Wood, No Kingdom: Political Ecology in the English Atlantic. His work spans the whole early modern Atlantic from Barbados to Ireland to Philadelphia. He is also my very dear friend, and I am so excited to have him with us here today. How you doing, Keith?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on, and very many congratulations on Past Lives.
We're going to get you on here even more times than we did on Tides of History. I can promise you're going to be a familiar face. So, Keith, who are we meeting today?
So today we are meeting a man named Joe, who was paid in the year 1762 by an agency of the city of Philadelphia, kind of quasi-independent agency of the city of Philadelphia, for carting loads of pebbles. And Joe is a man who is referred to in the sources as Negro Joe. That's going to become important for how we identify him and situate him within his broader community. But for our purposes today, I'm going to call him Joe because I think that that is how he would prefer to have been referred to. And the noun given before his name is a record of a deeply racist society. So I think we can avoid using it going forward today. So we'll just talk about Joe.
We know we're talking about Joe. We don't need that identifier. So tell me, how did you find Joe?
I'm working on a book right now that is looking at an urban environmental history of Philadelphia and its urban water systems. So the construction of multiple drinking water systems from the time of William Penn all the way up through piped water systems in the 19th century and the building of urban drainage systems. And in the course of doing that, I was working through the records of the bureaucratic agency that gets created in the middle of the 18th century, and that is going to be responsible for street paving, sewer construction, drainage, and in part, occasionally installing public pumps in the city streets.
So what kinds of records did this bureaucratic organization leave behind?
So the specific records I was working here are a minute book. Specifically, in this case, the minutes of the commissioners for paving streets from 1762 to 1768, which are held at the Library Company of Philadelphia. This is a bound volume. It's fairly large as a bound volume, so it's probably about 18 inches tall by maybe about 12 or 14 inches wide. So it's a big, thick book. It is written out in a very clean hand, so this was probably not the rough copy of notes. These were either minutes taken during meetings by a recording secretary and possibly cleaned up at some point. But this was the official record book of this committee. And in a minute, if anyone here has been involved in any type of organization from a labor union to a parent-teacher association, when you're doing a business meeting, you follow rules and write things down. There's no Roberts rules because the Roberts of Roberts rules is not going to show up until the middle of the 19th century. But there is a minute-taking practice for corporate records, for governments, for institutions that is present in English language sources, both in England and across the Atlantic throughout the entire early modern period. And by the 18th century, it's pretty well developed. So this is going through the minute books.
It's pretty hard to overstate how much a source like that is essentially crack for historians. These kinds of documents give you access to bits of life that you are never going to find elsewhere, to like descriptions of built environments, how jobs get done, who gets hired to do jobs, how much they're getting paid. These kinds of sources, well, I can understand maybe for our listeners at first blush, the minutes of urban committee meetings may not sound especially exciting, but these are the kinds of places where you find real people in history. You find real people, you find real experiences, you find aspects of mundane life that are really, really important that you're just not going to find elsewhere.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think one of the best compliments I received when I presented something related to this, but where I was working through a corporate minute book, was that someone said, "Wow, you actually made corporate minute books feel kind of interesting." The kind of is an important qualifier, maybe, but nonetheless, I find this type of record to be absolutely fascinating because you get a sense of things that can feel mundane, but I think a lot of people, even in the present, haven't necessarily thought about what goes into something like their street getting paved. And it can be tough to figure out how stuff works in the present moment. And there's a lot of assumptions we can make. And these give us, I think, just such rich detail for how stuff worked. That, to me, is fascinating.
Speaking as someone who lived in the wonderful city of Los Angeles for a long time, I would say that LADWP, Department of Water and Power, their procedures were never clear to me, despite many, many, many interactions with them. I mean, you are preaching to the converted as far as these kinds of sources go, because I had to read so many god-awful literary texts trying to understand scraps of important information about the ancient and the medieval world, where you are so desperately trying to read between the lines to figure out, just at a mechanical level, how stuff worked. And having sources like this, being able to look at sources like this, I mean, it's like a breath of fresh air, because it matters how cities work and whether cities work. The lives of the people who are doing that work matter. And otherwise, you're never going to see them. You're never going to know that they existed. These are the kinds of things that tell you that this whole aspect of the world was there and that we can know things about it.
Yeah. And I think it has a huge amount of significance. You know, I heard you on another podcast say that one way to think about how people might have known or understood the end of Rome and whatever fall transition, however you want to call it, is that one day there was a problem in the bridge and no one came to fix it, or the bridge fell down and no one replaced it. And so something like that, it really is quite consequential. And then seeing how a society builds its capacity to do things defines that type of capacity as something worth doing, gives you, I think, a really broad reflection of what that society is, of how it functions, of what people understand to be the goals and values. And I think that can be a really heroic story about building infrastructure and the forging of America. And I think looking at Joe's experience here, it also tells us something really important about what exactly values look like. In this case, at a very mundane aspect of hauling gravel to a street paving job, what that can tell us about ideas about race, equality, freedom, and work in colonial America.
I'm going to get a little bit squishy here for a second, but when you're reading documents like this and you found this entry that tells us that Joe existed, what does that feel like to you to kind of catch a glimpse into a person's life?
I'm a historian who tends to be really bad at thinking about people. You know, this has been the case since we were in grad school together. I tend to be really interested in systems. How does a system function? How does a bureaucracy function? How does a process function? And there's so many historians who really love uncovering people, and I am typically not one of those historians. At the same time, I do always try to keep track in my notes of people's lives, where they come in and where they matter. And in this case, it was just so important to me because in thinking about this system and how things were built, the presence of Joe here relatively early in the broader history of Philadelphia's free Black community and thinking about wage rates there, and we'll get into Joe's status or potential status a little bit later on. But being able to find this person and get a sense of what his daily job was, getting a sense that there were interracial work crews for public works projects, that ends up being really important, you know, as you see photos of public works projects from the New Deal, from city archives, from other places around the country, people often thinking with a kind of 20th century brain, even 21st century brain, can be surprised to see people interacting across lines that can feel really hard in American history, even if not often from the position of equality. I was really happy to find Joe here, to find an aspect of his life. And it's really important to me as well to just get a sense of who was doing this work. And we have things, you know, I read through many volumes of one of the people who would have been not Joe's immediate boss, but about three levels above him within this bureaucracy. Those are the types of people who leave stuff behind. Even then, it's kind of rare for them to leave stuff behind, the sort of middle managers of history. But it's just so rare to get a clear anecdote about someone's life who is a working person, and to be able to, in this case, hopefully talk about some aspects of his experience of life as a working person is really important.
As someone who has known you for a long time and has read practically all of your work over that period, you've never given yourself enough credit as a people person. Like, you care about systems because of how they impact people, not because you care about systems as systems. You care about these things because they impact people's lives, and you care about people's lives. So come on, man. Come on. All right. So let's build out the world around Joe a little bit. So we're talking about 1762, 1760.
Yeah, in 1762 is when we have the records of Joe being paid. So we have a record from him in September of 1762 and then November of 1762 for when the payments to him occurred.
So what does Philadelphia look like at this point in time? I mean, is it big city, small city, important place, not important place? Who lives there?
So Philadelphia at this point is becoming a very important city in North America. There's an ongoing debate about what exactly the city's population looks like. But in 1760, there's somewhere between 17,000 to 18,000 people living in the city, a number that's going to increase pretty rapidly up until around 1800. It's a fast-growing city from the 1760s onward. The debate among demographic historians is it really, really fast or just really fast? But it is rapidly growing. That is something that contemporaries notice. When Benjamin Franklin is writing about explosive population growth in his debates with Thomas Malthus, he in part is inspired by his experience of being in Philadelphia. In the 1760s, Philadelphia is a city that is expanding slowly westward. So for any of your listeners from Philly or anyone who has spent time in Philly, Philly today extends well beyond the piece of land between the Delaware and Schuylkill Rivers. At the time, its geography was even more constrained to just formally between the Delaware and Schuylkill Rivers, but the overwhelming majority of settlement in 1760 was in the blocks just adjacent to the Delaware River, which is the dividing line between Pennsylvania and New Jersey. And the city is sort of slowly moving west from that initial hub of settlement that was built right up along the banks of the Delaware River. And you're starting to get an increasingly well-developed central city located along the banks. And then you're getting some cheaper housing and fringe housing built up along the southern, western, and northern edges of the city. And for people at the time, the northern edge is around the Vine Street Expressway in today's geography, and what we would think of as South Philly, so everything below South Street. That area is going to be a separate municipality for a good chunk of this time. In terms of infrastructure, one of the reasons we know about this is in the 1750s, the colonial government and the city's government undertake a pretty significant shift to start more aggressively paving, grading, and regulating the city's streets, building sewers, building an urban drainage system that's meant to be connective in various ways. There had been attempts in the decades prior, but there's a boom in building out in the 1750s and 1760s. So this is a growing place. it's a place where there are still going to be dirt and grass streets, but also a place where you're going to see paving and infrastructure that would have felt modern to the people at the time.
This is something that it has been hard for me to wrap my head around as a, you know, not a historian of the Americas, is that like Philadelphia was not a new place in the 1750s, 1760s, and the colonies were not new. Like, I think there's this kind of idea that we have in the back of our heads that like, oh, it was a generation or two. Like, no, people had been there for a century. Like, this is a real city that has real roots. There are generations of inhabitants. The colonies are very much their own place in a way that I think is underrated or not fully understood by most lay people.
Yeah, exactly. In the case of Philadelphia, there had been lots of European settlement in the area. There obviously were indigenous peoples there, particularly the Lenape were there and remained there. And you have treaties with Penn in the 1680s. You have efforts to build up Philadelphia in the 1680s that start. But there's records from the city council dealing with complaints about flooded streets in the 1710s. So you've had almost half a century of efforts at urban development and thinking about how do you deal with streets in a city that had been in place. And Philadelphia is also, it's really an interesting place because it was planned out as a kind of model and utopia for anti-urban urbanism. So a city that was not supposed to have all the bad things that William Penn associated with cities. It's a model of urbanism and urban planning in the colony. And it's really developing, not necessarily along the lines that Penn wanted, but this is a city that's gone through significant changes and in which there's real thinking about what urban life means in a colonial context.
So let's shift the focus a little bit. Does slavery exist in Pennsylvania at this time? And I mean, what are race relations like in Pennsylvania and in Philadelphia specifically?
So slavery is a feature of Pennsylvania more or less from the word go. Pennsylvania's Quakers who come along with Penn have really intense relationships with the Caribbean, mercantile relationships and other relationships. That means they are going to be involved in products and commodities produced with the labor of enslaved people, as well as in the trade of enslaved people. So they are bound up in slavery in pretty much every side of an economy that is shaped by the institution of slavery. Pennsylvania itself is a place in which enslaved people are a part of the labor force, as is Philadelphia. And by the 1750s and really into the 1760s, you actually see some intensification in imports of enslaved people of African descent into Pennsylvania. So rather than something that is a dying institution or anything like that, in the 1750s and 1760s, slavery in many ways is booming. This is despite some really ambiguous and contradictory and often hypocritical Quaker opposition. So there are Quaker abolitionists and opponents of slavery or specific aspects of slavery, the slave trade. Throughout the 18th century, their opposition will intensify in the 1750s. And as we'll talk about a bit later, Quakers in Philadelphia do things like set up free schools to educate both enslaved people of African descent and Philadelphia's small free Black community as well. The character of urban slavery in Philadelphia will look different from other places where things like baptism, literacy, marriage are even more tightly restricted. But this is still very much a slave society and a society shaped profoundly by slavery. Ultimately, when you see the first stirrings of abolition that people in Pennsylvania are going to claim as quite important, you get the Pennsylvania Abolition Society in 1775, and a very radical Pennsylvania legislature passes the Gradual Emancipation Act in 1780. Even that doesn't immediately abolish slavery. It means that everyone born after a certain date would be manumitted on their 28th birthday. So it still bakes in a really long time of coerced labor in which people remain in a condition of slavery, even as there is a point of manumission baked into this law. So yes, Pennsylvania is a place in which slavery is very much a part of it. And there's a lot of good historians looking at the ways in which, even after the Gradual Emancipation Act, there were efforts, including by people like George Washington, to circumvent it by rotating people across, at that point, state lines, with the goal of preventing manumission.
Okay, there's a whole bunch of threads that I want to pull on in what you just said there. The first one is the character of urban slavery. I think especially in an American context and in a early modern and modern context, there's this idea that enslaved people's labor was fundamentally agricultural, that it was out in fields or working in a plantation house, things like that. And I'm so glad that we're talking about this particular place and context, because it tells us that, like, slaves did whatever jobs people needed them to do. Slavery is fundamentally about work and making people work and making people do the jobs that need doing. And in an urban context, those are urban jobs. And there's never a sense anywhere that, like, there are jobs that you don't have enslaved people do. It's just that, are those jobs available and do you need labor for them? So we don't know what Joe's legal status actually was from the information we have.
No, the records that we have record how much he was paid on two occasions for his work in hauling gravel with a cart. But other than the label that he's given that indicates his race or the way he was identified racially in the documents, there's nothing that indicates whether or not he was enslaved or free. And it's really difficult to tell. And that gets to the character of urban slavery. There are people who are enslaved who receive wages for their work in an urban context. How much of their wages they get to keep is going to vary really greatly. Particularly, one of the things I wish more people would understand about the way slavery in what becomes the United States will work, particularly in the 18th and 19th centuries, is that even as we tend to focus on the plantation system as kind of the paradigmatic vision of what slavery is, there are various white people who own enslaved people or claim ownership over enslaved people that are trying to come up with all sorts of novel labor relations, hiring out systems for what we would think of in some ways as factory work or as mining work, things like that. And that is work that is waged, but just because you are making a wage doesn't mean that you're free. So we're uncertain here about whether Joe was part of Philadelphia's free Black community, whether Joe was enslaved. Given the nature of Philadelphia's elites, many of whom owned country property as well as city property, and they would often refer to their country properties as plantations, a person who is enslaved by one of those people could in fact move between the plantation labor model and an urban labor model over the course of their life. So they could experience multiple different forms of labor regimes involving enslaved people, moving in what would feel to us like a really, really tight and small geography. I mean, one of the things that people who know Philadelphia should remember about this is that there were country estates called plantations in what is today the Northern Liberties, which if you walked to from Center City, you wouldn't even think that you had left Philadelphia. And you wouldn't have in today's terms.
You mentioned too, and this is again something that I don't think we often think about, that Delaware was full of plantations. It's Tidewater. I mean, it's part of that kind of cultural complex, right? And that's right next door. There are plantations all around Philadelphia. I'm really fascinated by this because it's such a good reminder that slavery is not a singular thing. And that's why we always, when we can, we always talk about slaveries in the plural rather than a singular, because it encompasses so much variation. And even in a single person's life, they can be experiencing different forms of slavery, different relationships, and that within the colonies, there are different models of slavery and different ideas about how it's supposed to work. But the one thing I want to pull on here is the economic sophistication involved in this kind of understanding of slavery, that it's in no way, shape, or form incompatible with sophisticated economic thinking. It actually goes hand in hand with them and enhances some aspects of it. Like, being able to think of labor as a thing that has a price and has a value is not necessarily as straightforward as we think it is today, where all work is wage work. Wage work is a squirrely thing for most of human history. And there are always ideas bound up with it about subservience and servitude and who's in charge of you. And are you really free if you're accepting wages from another person? That was a huge thing in the ancient world. That's why elites generally preferred to have slaves running their enterprises, is because one free person, it was very difficult for them to legally act on behalf of another free person. No problem for a slave. But like, that's something I think we're seeing here, is that like, you can hire out enslaved people. You can kind of chunk up their time. The person themselves is an asset with a monetary value. And all of this goes hand in hand with a sophisticated, blossoming early modern economy. It's not like these people are stuck in the past somehow because they are using slave labor.
No. I mean, this is a deeply commercial society. Exploiting forms of coerced labor is bound up with everything from shopkeeping to public infrastructure. And one of the questions that keeps coming up in a number of these public works discussions is about exactly what wages people in coercive situations should be paid, or people who, by virtue of their race, can be paid less. So later on, in some of these same records, there's an attempt to restrict the number of Black workers that can be part of a garbage collection crew. They're referred to as the scavengers, which is sort of the first trashmen in the area. Black workers are restricted to no more than 50% of the work crew. And in thinking about, well, why would that restriction be there? The city agency was contracting with a private individual who essentially bid on what we would think of today as bidding on a trash pickup contract. And there was a day rate that that person would be paid to cover the labor of the whole crew, with specifications on how many people, how many horses, and how many carts. But the city was concerned there about essentially the person who had won the bid pocketing more of the day rate by trying to hire cheap and exploited labor. And so there's a relationship here between how they're thinking about exploitable labor, or people who can be paid less for the same work, and the relationship between that and other kinds of workers. This comes up quite a lot in a lot of different ways. Later on, after the presence of Black workers becomes tougher to track in these documents, there's a moment in which the people who run one of the city's jails contract with the people who are doing street paving to have prisoners provide coerced labor. And it's a real conundrum for the streets commissioners, because they're trying to figure out how much they need to pay prisoners. And they're pretty sure that it should be less than other people, but they don't know how much less. And so they have a debate. They don't record the exact terms of the debate of how much to pay for coerced labor. So, I mean, one of the things they're trying to navigate in their thinking throughout here is that a lot of these systems are dependent upon forms of coerced labor, but they are also imagining that this type of work is supposed to be supporting the city's poor white laboring population. So, right, the racial thinking about incarcerated people and how they're paid are all bound up in the economic calculus here for how do you get a street paved.
I had never thought that there would be that much thought put into who gets to work on the paving crew. That is deeply fascinating. So when we look at these actual documents, can you walk me through what it is they're actually saying? So it says, Joe is hauling 19 loads of pebbles. He's paid in September of 1762, £5, 4 shillings, sixpence. 19 loads of pebbles. Do we have any sense for where these might have come from, or what kind of materials he's using? Where is the cart coming from? Do we think he owns that, or is he renting it? Like, can we dig into any of those details and build that out?
It's not entirely clear if the cart is his or not. One of the things that shows up in some of the records for scavengers, for other haulers, is that much in the way that owning a truck now can really make a difference in a working person's life if they're engaged in certain types of physical labor, owning a cart really can allow someone to get out of laboring jobs. They're still doing hard physical labor, but out of being the person who would say, like, just unloading the cart into someone who can kind of bid in to some of these jobs. It's unclear whether or not the cart is Joe's, and that's not specified at all. In other records, it really never specifies whether or not the carter owns their cart or not, so it's tough to tell. The location of the pebbles is a really interesting question, and this gets to other ways in which we see the economic calculus happening from the streets commissioners, and the agency will change name a couple of times, but at first they haul from quarries that are just outside of the 18th century city limits from some of those rural areas, which ask additional questions. For example, if there are people who are enslaved involved in the digging, we don't know because it just says hauled from the northern liberties, but it doesn't say where. Over time, as the municipal budget gets tight, the budget of the street commissioners gets tight, they attempt to engage in essentially a recycling process. So as they are digging in one street to build a sewer, they are demanding that the laborers kind of set aside the pebbles and gravel in a pile so that way they can be hauled to be used as paving fill for other jobs. And at first, they're just contracting out to buy quarried pebbles and other paving materials. They will attempt to cut costs at various points in time. So at this point, it's probably being hauled from outside the city, although there may have been some early efforts at what will later be documented as essentially gravel recycling or paving fill recycling, but it's not clear from what's here.
So this is a lot of work for Joe. He's making a bunch of trips back and forth. This is a sizable endeavor for him. And £5, that's a fair bit of money for a task like this.
It is. £5 is a good amount of money, but the historian Billy Smith did a calculation on what he saw as the bare minimum amount that a person would need to supply themselves and their family with food, paying rent on a dwelling room or possibly a dwelling of their own. These are not luxurious. I just want to mention that. Clothing and fuel. And it came out to £55 per year, which means Joe, if he were to get to that bare minimum and support a family at the basic necessities without having anyone else in the family or household work and contribute additional wages to that, that would mean 10 such total of these jobs. So 9 ones beyond this. One of the things that Smith and other economic historians found, and this is why it's important you bring up wage work, is that the opportunities for wage work to get to that £55 threshold were not as plentiful as we might imagine. There's a big debate in the history of early America and of Philadelphia itself about whether southeastern Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania more broadly, was a site of opportunity and a good country for a poor man. Implicit in that poor man, we should see white in parentheses there. But the argument for the American colonies and Pennsylvania, Philadelphia area in particular, it was a place where if you were a poor worker doing manual work type jobs, you wouldn't just get by, you had the chance to get ahead. So in other words, broadly distributed economic opportunity. There's also been other historians who have pointed out that, oh, that happens sometimes, but it didn't happen other. And availability of work is really one of the key questions for this. Anyone who knows people who work in the trades today, people who are laborers who work on road crews, things like that, knows that often the big question for people working in the trades is not always just the rate for a job. It's how long does the job last and how many jobs can you put together in a year? Those are questions that also would have applied to someone like Joe. How many times could he get this? And what would have been particularly challenging for Joe over the course of the 1760s is that there are cyclical economic crises that hit. And in the 1760s, following war, Philadelphia suffers an economic crunch. And so, the interesting question here is, who are the first workers who are going to get cut or who are going to lose opportunities to get jobs, particularly when there is public concern about honest laborers unable to find work? Well, it's people who are seen as outside of the normative labor pool. Black Philadelphians like Joe. You know, that is one of the reasons to think about some of these racist restrictions on access to public work jobs. There's an attempt by the city to preserve job opportunities for its poor white residents, and that would have really hurt someone like Joe in his effort to get to that 55-pound threshold that meant bare minimum sustainability if he was supporting a family.
Another piece of that is seasonality of available work was so much stronger than it is today. There are plenty of building jobs you can get inside in the winter. You can do interior electrical work in the winter. In the early modern and definitely in the pre-modern world, when people want wage labor, they want it at harvest time. They want it during the summer when the weather is good enough to be, you know, doing things like safely laying down sand and gravel for a new roadway. The work is not coming at the times when you're really going to need the income coming in. It just makes it infinitely harder to be a wage laborer than it is in the present in this particular period of time. But that's also one of the reasons why slavery as an economic model makes sense, because if Joe was enslaved and his owner is getting some substantial portion of whatever those wages were, because he's owned, the owner, thinking as an economic agent, is like, what other jobs do I have for this guy to do? This is one of the reasons why you often find enslaved people being hired out for wage work, is because their owners can eat the cost of the other time by finding them other, to put it in crass terms, economically productive things for them to do in a way that doesn't make sense for wage laborers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the things about ambiguous status, that in one person's life, it is possible to move through things. And again, if you think about the geography of the types of people who own slavery, they moved seasonally between urban and rural areas. And so there's the possibility of people being forced through different types of slavery, different forms of labor that enslaved people could be subjected to over the course of a year, over the course of their lifetime. And it can be tough, except for some exceptional cases where maybe we have a memoir, or maybe we have kind of very well-developed records to get a sense of how a person's laboring life would have moved in this. I mean, one of the other ways that, as we see from later demographic analysis of Philadelphia's free Black community, one of the ways that free Black people in Philadelphia dealt with lower wages, difficulty accessing economic opportunities, racist discrimination, and just the availability work, there's a higher household size in often smaller dwellings. So essentially, one of the ways that access to work here could play out is if you have a large household in which lots of people are working. There's no assumption, say, of a single male worker being able to get enough money to get the bare necessities. You also just have larger household sizes because you need more people together in order to make enough money to make rent. And so, again, one of the ways to think about this one job Joe did is, would he have been able to find another 9 of them? What does he do when the city's construction basically kind of shuts down for the 2 coldest months of the year, sometimes for late fall through early spring? Just all of this work is shut down. If he owns the cart, if he's a free person, does that mean he's able to pick up other types of work, hauling? It's all quite uncertain from it here, but it would have been a real struggle to just put everything together over the course of the year. And frankly, making this work from Joe's perspective likely involved thinking with family and community about how an extended household, networks of kin and friends, churchmates, fellow congregants might work together to put together enough to get by.
That is so deeply fascinating, because it locates him not just as an economic actor, but within an economic community, in addition to a social, cultural, racial community, that all of those things overlap in really fascinating ways. And this is all thanks to this one record. We have built out a portrait of this person from one record. And this is the beauty of being a historian, man. But by way of conclusion, if you could ask Joe anything about his life, and his experiences, what would you ask him?
Given what I've been working on in this project in particular, paving the city's streets and trying to design what people felt a good city should look like was part of the vision. And that vision was often built on ways that are small, like we see in restricted access to jobs, and then also large in terms of really weird ideas about race, climate, and public health, was bound up in deep-seated inequalities. And honestly, what I would want to know from Joe is, what does a beautiful city look like to you? I would want to hear from Joe what his vision of a beautiful city would be. As someone who understands what it means to build a street, but also as someone who understands what it means to survive and hopefully find a way of thriving in a society that had, in some cases, more opportunities than other places in colonial America and things like education, but that was still profoundly stacked against him. I'd want to know what his sense of a fair and beautiful city would look like.
That is a beautiful question to ask him. And Keith, it is such a pleasure getting to do this with you. And I look forward to doing it many, many, many more times here on Past Lives.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining me. And I look forward to chatting with you again. If you haven't already, please subscribe to our Patreon, linked in the description. It's only $7 a month, and you get access to tons of bonus content, like interviews with great scholars, Q&As with me, and much more. You can follow me on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick or on Blue Sky at Patrick Wyman. Past Lives is a 100% independent production, and your support is what allows us to make this show. So, thank you. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. The music and sound design is by Gabriel Gould. Until next time, this has been Past Lives.